Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 403.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about culture, and where we look at the discourse around Beyoncé's new album and say, no, I'm not going to be roped in. It's a country album, and it's got a lot of other genres, and it's not a big deal. Leave her alone, and let's all stop talking about it. I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and my God, does the media love joining a bandwagon? I'm not even sure if anyone's really against anything. Like, one guy said something, and then everyone's like, there's discourse. I don't know. As promised, today we're not going to talk about Beyoncé. Instead, we're going to talk about the act of deciphering a man's text messages, something that women around the world are intimately aware of. We're also going to talk about open-toed shoes. Yeah, that's right. We don't fucking shy away from the hard issues here on Fake the Nation. And we'll talk about the GOP's money woes. And finally, the Global Happiness Report is out. And where is America on that report? Today, oh, folks, today's panel. What a panel. We have joining us for the severalth time. He's a writer. He's written on many of the TV shows that you love. He's host of the Yo Is This Racist podcast, which has a wonderful Venn diagram with the Fake the Nation podcast. There's a select number of you that just that listen to both podcasts very studiously. And you're special and you're better than everyone is basically what I'm saying. And this guy is better than a lot of us. He is the wonderful Andrew T. Hey, Andrew.
That is such a curveball at the end. I, of course, reject that. I am equal to, we're all equal here. But thank you. Hi.
In my heart, you're better than a lot of people, Andrew. We are also joined by someone who is, I'm going to say, well-regarded better than a lot of people. Andrew's shaking his head very squarely in the yes fashion, because this man is a legend. He is an icon. He is a comedian, which is the only thing he really wanted me to say. But I have to say other things because I want you to know the depth of how awesome this guy is. He's on the road right now with a group called Who's Live, so you should see where you can see him live. I've seen him live. It's one of the life's great experiences to see him live. He also has a podcast called The Smartest Man in the World, because he, in fact, is such. It is the one and only Greg Proops. Hey, Greg.
Good morning, Nagin. Good morning, Andrew.
And before we get into the show, I just want to let listeners know that they can go to patreon.com/Nagin Farsad to support the show and get really fun bonus episodes. We really get into life's little like conundrums on the bonuses. And for as little as $4 a month, you can get bonus episodes of the show. And it's really it's a great way to support the show, but also a great way to just get like extra content. If you like Fake the Nation, then you get more Fake the Nation. And then that's, you know, like that's what we all want, right?
Yes.
All right, let's get into it with topic number one. So women have spent now decades decoding men's text messages and terse emails. We probably could have cured cancer, right? With the time we've wasted, the time we've put into understanding these messages. But it's so prevalent, and there's actually now a term for it. It's called hermeneutic labor. Now, Greg, you're the only person on this podcast that probably walked into this recording knowing the definition of hermeneutics. So I'm going to put you on the spot by asking you, can you tell us what hermeneutic labor is?
My understanding is that hermeneutic labor is the deciphering of things that are are, you know, arcane, certain, you know, runes that medieval monks might leave and whatnot. Etchings from another civilization that we're not, that humans aren't quite, you know, copacetic with. Obviously the communication gap between men and women is enormous and almost entirely on men. It's my understanding. Men really don't make it clear. My wife is always saying to me, and of course I don't listen. My wife is always saying, be clear. Cause I'll go on and on and on. And of course I dissemble and diffuse. So that's my issue, is that not so much text as my spoken word is as hermeneutically impenetrable as a text.
So just so we're clear, and this is for you, Andrew, I'm just going to spell it out. Hermeneutic labor is basically interpreting shit. It comes in three phases: interpreting the feelings of others, determining when and whether to bring difficult emotional conversations up, and interpreting your own feelings vis-a-vis, you know, the message that you're decoding. So, Andrew, I don't know. You've been in dating scenes, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very charitable of you. I appreciate it.
Someone has deigned to look at you in a mm-hmm. romantic fashion, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, do you know? And I'm sure that your text messages has been the subject of hermeneutic labor. Mm-hmm. Have you been aware of it, like, as a man who has dated, who has been in a dating scene?
Have I been aware of it? Never in time to extricate myself from the problems it causes. It's always after the fact. I'm like, fuck, I probably could have been more communicative, but this is already a fight. So,
right. So you have seen moments where you're like, oh, if I was just clearer about that thing, this all would have been better. Like,
yeah. Pathetically late, I will just say. Okay. You know, on the order of days, weeks, months, and occasionally years, I'm like, I could have just said what I was feeling.
And this is to both of you. Is it that you don't know what you're feeling specifically? Like, what's the problem?
Well, you know.
What's up with you guys?
Right? That whole male gene of not wanting to share things emotionally. I know it's a well-worn and terribly overly trodden trope, but, you know, you'll go out with your buddies and then your wife will say, how's so-and-so's family, or how's so-and-so's wife doing? And you'll go, I don't know. And you'll be like, you've spent 7 hours with them today. And at no point did you discuss. And you're like, what did you guys talk about? And you're like, I don't know, movies, you know.
Other stuff.
Baseball, nothing. I mean, men literally will fill the hours with nothing rather than get to anything substantive in their life. And I think that's the crux of the whole. I'm in a group with five other, however many men. And there's a lot of people looking at their phone and watching basketball, which isn't the most riveting intellectual exercise. We get on stage together and we're full of creativity, but the hours spent in the van together are not the most illuminating moments of my life.
I mean, yeah. I mean, so do you feel like as you grow older, not to suggest that either of you are aging, but let's say you were subject to everyone else, the typical aging process, the way the rest of us are. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself getting better at it? Because it's like, I'm not dating right now. I know that in my 20s, I spent a fucking shit ton of time reading messages and just like, you know, and what's frustrating is like, for example, Andrew, do you spend a lot of time decoding the messages of women?
Wonderful question. You're right. Probably not. I feel like often there's some nexus of I probably should care more. And, and the women in my life are way more communicative.
Right. So like doesn't leave very much for you to doubt.
Yeah, there's right. less to do. I will say actually that the cracks of me getting myself out of this behavior actually might have started in my participation in one of the most toxically masculine things available, which is I started playing poker during the pandemic. And I learned in those like social circles, even when it was online, but now live, that I think on some level, I thought other people were psychic with regards to what's in my head, which is one of the reasons why I was like having so much trouble. I was like, they know what I'm feeling, even if I don't.
Right.
And it was sitting around with this bunch of bozos and seeing plainly that they don't know what's in my head, that I was like, oh, maybe other people don't, especially the women
right.
in my life.
Right. So then playing poker made you realize that you had to actually yeah. express something.
Yeah. Or when I don't, that I'm hiding it.
Right, 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 right. Wow. That's really interesting. That's a really weird yeah. area to find it.
Yep. Some would argue one of the worst places to find it.
Right.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we used to play poker in our group, and Ryan Stiles is our, you know, star guy. And he's the most unavailable emotionally in real life. And he was the best poker player.
Right.
Because you absolutely hadn't the slightest notion of what was going on. Whereas I'm like playing with a child. I'll go like, all of mine look like Valentine's. You know?
You're the dogs with the tail wagging and the dogs playing poker painting.
Oh yeah, and frankly, in the old days, the whole appeal of playing poker to me was so that I could, you know, drink and do drugs.
Right.
I never understood the gambling part. But the collegial.
Yeah.
Fraternity was what I was there for.
Well, folks, we read a really just fun think piece in the Washington Post on hermeneutic labor. And of course, I just couldn't I felt so liberated that there was, in fact, now a term for it, that in fact, women are basically anthropologists the world over, like trying to, you know, and it is as complicated as deciphering like hieroglyphics from another era. You know what I mean? It can be literally like that. And so so I just had to share that, you know, the coining of this term and that, ladies, we're not fucking crazy. It happens. You know what I mean? We have to do this. It's ridiculous and annoying. All right. Let's move on.
A small mnemonic, which is kind of nice that it also in my head is like, oh, it's her minute ick.
Oh, that's what you were coming up with this whole time. Okay.
Yep. I'm focused. I'm dialed in.
Her minute ick. All right, folks, let's move on to another point in culture, which is that the warm weather is slowly but surely on its way. And with all of the warm weather fashions that come with it. And for The Office, those warm weather fashions have always been tricky. Now, I was actually like pleasantly surprised to see a "What Do We Wear at the Office" New York Times article, because it feels like, oh, we're still going into offices. That's right. Like, you know, some people are still really fucking doing that. And like, that's great. I love it. And so this was we came upon this question in the Times, which was very specific, which is that how much toe cleavage is too much toe cleavage? Like, should you be exposing your dogs in the office? And I know this goes back to an earlier day for me where I had like a real job and I sat at a cubicle and I was like a person. I'm not like a person anymore, so I wear as much fucking toe cleavage as I want. But I did like have a strong, like a visceral reaction to feeling like I don't want to see, you know, I maybe don't want to see a lot of toe cleavage in the office in particular. What are your feelings?
Well, I've always said that God in her infinite wisdom made one terrible mistake, and that was the size and shape of men's feet. men's feet are horrible, heinous, submarine sandwiches full of regret and shame and should never be seen. Men go, oh, I want to wear flip-flops. And I'm like, why? What about our comfort? I'm not supposed to gaze upon your feet and then somehow consume food into my body in the same lunar cycle. I don't get it. Men's feet are to be hidden. You have to ask yourself two questions if you're wearing flip-flops. Am I four and am I at the beach? So if the answer is no, either of those, then you oughtn't wear them. And then guys are like, what do I want to be comfortable? Wear deck shoes. Deck shoes. Deck shoes go over your feet. That's how that works. Women, whatever. Women at least have the fighting chance for their feet to be attractive. And in an office, though, you know, I would say it's an office, you know, like I don't want to see performers on stage wear flip-flops. I don't want to see the president and the vice president wear flip-flops. No. I think there's a certain amount of, you know, however, having said that, I think open-toed sandals aren't a crime against humanity. I think women have two things on their mind a lot of the time, and that's when the summer comes, strappy sandals and, you know, must destroy paternal hierarchy.
Yeah. Gotta, I mean, I have to kind of cop to a double standard here, which is that I specifically don't want to see a man's foot. Yeah. I specifically don't want to, like, I can see a woman's foot. And again, and it's like, yeah. I don't know if men did more pedicuring or something. I'm not sure. Like, maybe there's a world where I could see a man's foot and it would be okay. But the fact of the matter is most men's feet are not okay. I would say a large portion of women's feet are okay because they put – it's like what comes with the hermeneutic labor is pedicures. Those two things are inextricably linked.
Yes.
So I feel like there is a double standard here. This is woman's privilege. We all have our forms of privilege, and woman's privilege is that, like, she can kind of show her feet. Andrew, where are you? By the way, I should point out, this is a little fun detail, is the royal family still has a rule of no open toe shoes on major occasions. Major public occasions. And there's also an official name for the condition of having an extreme aversion to feet. It's called podophobia, which I didn't know. but podophobia. So, Andrew, what's your rule of thumb or your rule of foot?
I know. I think, unfortunately, I fall probably into the exact same. It's like a thing where I'm like, I should, my brain wants to be better than these gender roles about what's acceptable, and yet my gut goes to the exact same place. And I knew this because when I worked in an office in New York, there was a guy who was, you know, kind of like a hippie, free spirity kind of copywritery dude. And he would, and maybe part of this was like, he would occasionally paint his toenails at his cubicle.
What?
Which was, I think that maybe officially was my line that, like, come on, man, like, how about no, like, grooming in the office of any kind?
No grooming.
But I think probably at my heart there was some gut, like, I don't want to see this dude's toes.
Yeah, no, neither do. That sounds really actually troubling that someone was painting their toenails at the office.
Really unpleasant. All
right. Well, folks, in that sandal weather is nearly upon us. Please let me know your positions. They're going to be well documented in a full Fake the Nation rule book on footwear that I've been developing over the years. You know, as one does.
I have very strong feelings about this. I'm against seeing men's feet at any time. I also believe that men have this terrible prerogative where they feel like they can take their shirt off whenever they want.
Yes, they think,
and
that,
it's really gross to me.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the part of that problem is that it's not gross when it's a really fucking hot guy, and that's the problem.
Right, but it's not hot guys. It's other
guys. right, totally.
And I really feel like men need to cool it on that jazz, because it's like, why do men have the prerogative to, they want to wear flip-flops in public and they want to show their chess to everybody. And there's really a time and a place for that. And that's never.
All right, folks, let me know. Are you with Greg on the never showing of the chest and the feet and all of it? All right, folks, let's take a quick break and we'll hear from our sponsors. And then when we're back, we'll continue our chatter. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year. using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. And we are back and we're ready for topic number two. In the last 3 years, Trump has averaged $90,000 in legal fees a day, none of which he has paid himself. And now Trump has a new agreement with the RNC. This is basically since he installed all of his own people, including his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, as co-chair of the RNC. And the agreement is that donations coming in will first go to a Trump political action committee that pays his legal bills before the RNC gets a cut. Now, this is Trump's GOP, but inevitably people might be pissed about this. I don't know. What do you think, Andrew?
I just like how we are still this many years into Trump as a political figure being like, well, this violates the norms. And it's like,
right.
I don't know. I'm sorry, but maybe we should have just had rules. I feel like it shouldn't take one man who has the audacity to say, I don't care, when confronted with this is not typical, to bring democracy down. So it's shocking, I guess, that the RNC is only just getting to this, because it feels like, I guess they get burned last, but yeah, they're getting burned the same way everyone else has ever been.
And it's funny because the only reason this felt like very particularly like a special norm breaking was because it hurts down ballot RNC members. I mean, they actually need the RNC to do stuff. I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Greg?
I think we're at the same point we were at when Clinton was standing for re-election and when Obama was standing for re-election, which is to say that the GOP is completely thrown in the towel. By nominating this person who not only lost the last election brutally, but everyone he's endorsed or anyone he's touched has absolutely withered and died like a terrible asteroid. Having your daughter-in-law, who's clearly a sociopath and a karaoke sort of, she's at the karaoke level of politics.
Also, literally, she releases singles and stuff like that. I think loves karaoke.
The delusion is so grand.
Yeah.
The media is never, ever, ever going to cop to the fact that it's over. There is no more Republican Party. There's a Nazi party that they turned into. If there's going to be one, it's going to be a breakoff kind of. Remember the old days, I liked, George Herbert Walker when they didn't, just drop N-bombs and, that'll be the party that it splits off to. We're in the 1850s here where the Republican Party grew out of the Whig Party and the Whig Party disappeared. And this is more like the Copperhead Party of the 1850s where they're violently racist and that's what they are. The media can't say it because the media is owned by violent racists. So we're in this part where they're circling the drain. He's delusional. He's crazy. He hasn't said anything coherent in ages. He's facing insane legal trouble. Yesterday's primaries, 20% of the Republican voters are still not voting for him. And somehow somehow he's going to win. And we keep talking about what he's going to do when he's president, this whole Project 2025 thing and all that. He was president. Why are we acting like what he's gonna do? We saw what he gonna did. And it's a psychopathic plot to overthrow the government and become a Russian tool. So the reality is he's going to lose brutally. He's not only gonna lose, women have obviously come to the fore in this one, which is one of the main reasons the media can't deal with this or talk about it in any way. Because anytime women do anything or people who aren't white do anything, it's controversial. Anytime white people do something, like you said, Andrew, we're still saying he's breaking norms. Well, up until, 20 years ago, only white men ever held office or made laws or did anything. So that's what a norm is. A norm is what, and as my wife said to me yesterday, white men believe anything other white men say. And that's why this is dragging out to eternity. The truth is he's not going to win. There's no chance of him winning. And them funneling all their money to, if Joe Biden made Hunter Biden the chair of the Democratic National Committee and started funneling all the money, do you think the papers would stand for, I mean, the media outcry would just be.
Yeah.
But we're talking about someone who let a million people die and who's under 91 indictments and is in the middle of three gigantic trials right now and has no money. And we're still pretending that he's this powerful force and he's got all these ideas and none of it is true. He's a shriveled, horrible, drugged up maniac who's about to fucking lose again.
Okay, so Greg, you have been the first person on the show in the last several months. I think I'm right, Andrew. I'm not sure. But I think you have been the first person, I mean, who has forcefully said that he's not going to win.
He's so not going to win. And they know that.
Right?
Why would you let no money go to the down ballot if you thought your party was going to take back the House? They're going to lose the House. They're what,
I think they have, I think in a couple of weeks or something, it'll be like a majority of one. By one, they'll have the majority.
Hello.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Did they, last time there were a big red wave that materialized, in the middle of his first term in 2018, the Democrats took back the House, and thank fuck, otherwise we wouldn't have a country anymore. And, you know, they're going to lose the Senate too. They're not popular. You know, saying that you love guns and you don't care whether babies get shot by them, saying that you want women to be barefoot and pregnant, saying that you want that everyone who's not white is an animal and things like that, that's Nazi talk. And Americans aren't, we're not even, and I won't say this, I'll generalize here. White men are not to be trusted. I am an old white guy and I speak with some authority. White men will literally do anything to avoid anything being good for anyone else. Having said that, there are still going to be 30 or 40% of white men who do the right thing. And this is where he loses. It's because women are going to jump over. And that's that.
I think the majority of women do
the right thing, it's
I don't know who those numbers are, who those 20% are. Like, I don't know what the demographic breakdown of the 20% is that keep not voting for him in these primaries. But I can imagine it's a shit ton of women. And my question to you, Andrew, is, like, you heard Greg basically make his prediction. He is truly, and we fucking talk, you know, this podcast, we fucking talk about this shit at least a little bit every week, right? So. Mm-hmm. So are you surprised to hear that he is the first person that has gone out on this limb to make that prediction and to be so forceful? I mean, because I haven't fucking heard it from you, Andrew. So tell me, what do you think?
I will say I did not think of myself as a superstitious person until Greg started talking.
Yes! And I was like, that's what it is.
Even if I think, like, my rational mind is like, yeah, Greg sounds like he's probably right. I was just like, you're jinxing it, man. What are you doing?
No, exactly. I felt a lot of fear hearing him say that. And I, you know, look, I only do optimism. Like, that's been the mantra of Fake the Nation since, like, literally 2020. And I felt so much fear hearing Greg talk, saying the things that are, like, in the depths of my heart. The funny thing is, in the depths of my heart, in, like, the most dangerous part of my soul, I have extremely optimistic thoughts, which mirror literally what he just said. And I'm so scared to say them as forcefully. I do think,
that is, again, the utterly, like, believes in magic part of my brain was like, you can't. Oh, come on, man.
You can't be fucking reasonable like that. What are you talking about? But it's absolutely so right.
That's a me problem.
Yeah. And I also just want to add this other fun detail about this week, which is, so, you know, I wanted to talk about money and how angry down ballot Republicans must be to be literally left adrift at sea with no fucking help. That's crazy. Just so we understand, if we've learned anything from 2016, it's the down ballot races matter more than the presidential race, and that state races matter more than the presidential race, and none of that shit is going to function efficiently if the parties aren't operating efficiently. So that's one of the things that made this arrangement to me seem just outrageous. But the other fun little detail about this week is that the Truth Social stock fell a shit ton. His share was worth $6 billion last week, literally last Wednesday when we talked about it. And this week it's now worth $3.5 billion, which also is an overvaluated amount because the thing lost $50 million in revenue last year. It only made like $3 million, whatever. Like the whole thing is just a charade. And so there's even less, it speaks more to Greg's point. Like, this is all not adding up.
Well, he had to borrow money yesterday to pay that $175 reduced fine, and he borrowed it from a Shylock, who's a Russian op. So, I mean, if the media had any integrity, which – and I don't mean every single reporter. I hate
sure, sure. Yeah,
I love the press, and there's lots of great reporters. The giant entities that run the media are ancient, old, horrible men, and they wanted the tax break. And so without a horse race and without a false equivalency that both sides are the same, they can't exist. And both sides aren't the same, and there is no race going on. Let me put it this way. If I would go with the gambler, go online and look at what the odds are with London bookmakers that 45 has a chance of winning.
Oh.
Bookmakers only evaluate on the dotted line. And I'm not a gambler. I hate gambling, but I would say that's a great way to start is to he hasn't a snowball. What's the old civil? He hasn't the chance of a fiddler's bitch at Fredericksburg. He's not. Let me put it this way. Who at this point in your world, uh-huh. aside from your cousins who are all psychopaths like mine, I have white cousins, who has he added to his voter roll in the last 4 years?
Right. Yeah.
And that's where I'm at. It's like Biden's added a lot of people because a lot of people have been helped. A lot of women are understanding now that their only salvation is going to be to reinstate a democratic regime that's going to change everything back. Anyone who's not white, I think, has always known that the country sucks, the Supreme Court's an awful racist institution, and that there are no guardrails. Guardrails were a pretend thing that white people thought of because there was this gentleman's agreement.
Yeah.
Look at what the Senate looked like 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Isn't any.
It's gentleman's agreement, but who's gentleman is the is the question.
So now, and when people argue that the country's gone to shit, my argument is we have a black woman on the Supreme Court. We have a black woman in the White House. And that wouldn't have happened unless people fought their asses off to get those things. We did. They're there. We've had a woman speaker. We have a woman, a black lesbian woman as our press secretary for the White House. That wasn't going to just happen out of the air. It happened because people really, really fought and made it happen.
That happen. And so, yeah, like there are improvements. And why do we refuse? This is the other thing, Andrew, when we both got so scared, we refuse to accept when good things happen. It's so, I mean, I've talked about this on the show before, but it's like we do need to accept that good things happen.
I am maybe just a person who politically has always come from a place of negativity, which I understand is not this show, but I just need to be anxious about it because I feel like I think they hopefully are part and parcel of the same thing, which is like, otherwise I will simply rest on my laurels because I am very lazy.
Right. It's a motivating force for you.
Shit is bad.
That's
fine. A poker friend of mine literally texted me yesterday and was like, how can we make money betting against Republicans? And I was like, I think we could find some ways.
the London bookmakers or whatever. What are they called?
Yeah.
By the way, for a guy who doesn't like gambling, Greg, you've referenced it now multiple times.
That's my fault. I know, isn't that terrible? I feel like that's me.
All right, folks, let's move on to our third topic. The World Happiness Report is out. We're going to talk about it because for me, the headline was a doozy. The report first came out in 2012. And this is the first time since 2012 that the U.S. did not make the top 20 of happiest countries. We dropped to 23rd. And it's largely because of the under 30-somethings. They're unhappy. they're unhappier than their elder millennial and Gen X counterparts. They're wildly less happy than the 60 and older, because the 60 and older, if you just ranked them, they're 10th in happiness in the world, 60 plus Americans. So just fucking Andrew, explain to me why, what's happening? You make sense of it.
I just want to say I am older than this demographic. I'm an old ass millennial myself, so or young.
You're happier, right? Yeah, you need
apparently
to like dig in to your Gen Z whatever neighbor and like, yeah, you know, try and figure out what's going on.
I think it's I don't know. I mean, I think it's one of those like pretty openly, we'll start with economic and then availability of information and bleakness. I think to me, I will say a little bit, the thing that we read, I was a little surprised that like, I don't know why 20 is such an, it feels like an arbitrary dividing line to me. I'm just like,
Yeah,
I don't know. It's, yeah, we're unhappy. We're moderately unhappy, like America always is. Like, yeah, it just feels like within the statistical significance, I guess. I'm like, I don't know. You just pulled a bunch of people and like, yeah, now we're down, but who knows?
Greg?
Well, I haven't been 30 for several hundred decades. But I understand if you were growing up in this environment, housing is prohibitively expensive. Entering the job market is horrible. You know, my vocation as a stand-up comedian, when I started back in the right after World War II, we had we went to open mics because people went out every night of the week,
yep,
because there was no mobile phones and people barely recorded things on their VCRs and we had just gotten to the beta point of technology. So things were a lot different. And now I don't know how you would start as a comedian other than to go right to social media.
Right.
So the very distancing of social media, other than of course what we're doing here and again, where we're coming together over the devices that seek to divide us. I think is a real gigantic Everest of a challenge for young people. How do you connect? How do you integrate? How do you become part of the giant beehive that we all live in? And I think that might be where some of the unhappiness is. They also feel like their needs aren't being responded to. And I understand that when you see a gerontocracy, the kind that we have, it can seem like an edifice that'll never be broken down. Now, mind you, when I was a child, we had people like Nixon that we had to look at. And so it wasn't like it was golden glory days then. And I'm never one who says the past was better, because in the past, no one got to say anything unless they were a creepy dude. And so now we're at the point where creepy dudes don't get to say everything, which is why there's the tumult that there is, because when white creepy dudes see that other people get to talk, the world comes to an end. That's how, because their little pee-pee just and not over. So I think I understand their depression. Mind you, I'm over 60, so I'm elated.
You're 10th in the world.
The one thing I am elated about is I think the world's better than it was. And I think if you were 30, you wouldn't think the world was better than it was because you didn't see all the awful things. My parents were World War II generation, and I had to hear about the goddamn depression, you know, yeah. and World War II my whole life. And so that was a giant event for them. And then other people are more Vietnam oriented. And now we have loads of people who were born after 9/11. And what do they know about, you know, Reagan and how awful that was? So I understand wanting your own dismal outlook. I think it's almost necessary so that you can fight against it and break through to something new.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense at all?
No, absolutely. I mean, it like, right. So that, you know, you feel like you're being motivated by something negative so that you're prompted to action, as someone said in an earlier segment. But like, I think, so when we read this, a piece about this report, and it does come down to a lot of what you talked about, Greg. Their assessment is that, well, the pandemic was a chief driver of mental health challenges. And I think we're still seeing that, the kind of like how that's playing out, the aftermath of it for a lot of young people, for a lot of people who, you know, it's interesting because I was talking to a friend of mine last night who was just like, my husband cannot work remotely anymore. It's killing him. He is like deteriorating doing that. I'm like actively encouraging him to quit his job and find a job that forces him to go into an office. So that kind of thing, I mean, it's still playing out because, you know, we didn't like snap back, right? Mm-hmm. To open-toed shoes debates at the office. And, you know, so I think that's a big deal. The other thing this piece talks about is the lack of ability for people under 30 to feel connected and have a community, which is like something, I mean, look, I talk about it all the time. And whatever we think we're doing with like TikToks and fucking Instagram reels, it's not like doing that thing. You know what I mean? And that I think if anything, it kind of like actually makes us feel more alone. and sadder. And I mean, you know, the data shows it. Like, the data shows it.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, the summation of the findings was that young people are too online. They need to fucking go touch grass, as they say. And you know, it's I find it like deeply depressing. And I'm always, and I think it like as a parent has made me. And I hope it's really just like this generation, because I feel like I'm backlashing against it so hard with my own child. Like, I am constantly putting her around people, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because I'm so scared of her going into this, you know, lonely online wormhole.
Mm-hmm. Part of me, I have been observing some of my friends' kids, like the way they play like Fortnite or whatever, and realizing, because that is against, you know, or with human beings, they have a little crew of digital friends.
Sure. Yeah.
So I am trying to wonder, like, it does feel like there's an element of like, look, the genie's beyond out of a bottle. Like, this 9-year-old has a fucking iPhone. So like, I am just curious, like, and I am not a parent, so I don't know, but I'm like, is the sort of like no phones version of parenting the way to go? Or is there, hopefully someone can figure out a, like, there's a way that, again, it blows my mind that a child has an iPhone. 'Cause I was like, I would have fucking lost my mind if that happened.
Oh yeah.
But like, it's also just happening. So like, I don't know if someone else, not me, can figure out what to do with that.
Yeah. And that's also a norm thing, right? Like it's just become like a habit we formed of like, oh yeah, okay, so then I'll just give my kid an iPhone. Like,
yeah.
But that's not, you don't have to do that. Like, you don't have to do that. You know what I mean? And well, I know
The thing that I was seeing that was interesting was like, my friend essentially justified it because it was like, all his friends have iPhones.
Yeah.
So like, that also then becomes like a social thing on the other side.
But it's a little bit like movement building. I mean, this is this is what it is. It's movement building among parents to be like, let's band together.
Yeah.
Like a labor union and say no. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No. And none of our kids are going to have this fucking device. And that's just not how it's going to go. It's just not going to go that way.
They got to go outside and sharpen sticks like I did when I was a kid.
Exactly. Exactly. But also, I feel like this is so crazy. I feel like I'm always saying, you know, I was volunteering at my park this weekend, Tompkins Square Park, shout out. And there was a bunch of like NYU students and Lehman students and Fordham students that came out. And I was like, so happy to see them. And I also, like, I stopped myself from pulling them aside and being like, please go fuck a stranger tonight at a bar. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I, but that's what I want. Cause I was like, this is, I just read the World Happiness Report and I feel like you need to go and, you know what I mean? Find that dick and just sleep with it. And like, I just, but I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I know that's inappropriate, but like, that was how, I mean, you know, that's
you
what
text
I want.
Them that same thing. Just airdrop.
And then do some hermeneutic deciphering.
All right.
I think you're on the right track, Nagin. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think I'm reminded, like Richard Serra, the artist, just passed. And the reason I bring it up is Richard Serra made these gigantic installations. And there's some in New York and Los Angeles, wherever. And you're forced to, when you see a piece of Richard Serra's art, to interact with it. You have to go into it. You have to walk through it. It's a labyrinth. It's a challenge. It's a piece. And I think that's what we have to do as humans is like, get back to art. I have the huge advantage and joy of performing live all the time, which I've done since I was a kid. And when you perform live, you're always around people. You're interacting with people. You meet people. Yeah. You meet people after the show. You're in front of people. You get their immediate reaction all the time. So it keeps me from losing my mind. The deep gaping hole where my soul should be, of course, is filled by the shallow approval of laughter from strangers every 15 to 30 seconds. But even though that's my predilection, I think it makes you more of a person. I see people at coffee shops in LA sitting at a coffee shop with a bunch of other sexy people around with their computer in front of them and headphones on. And it's like, the point of going to the coffee shop is to pick up on the other sexy people.
Yeah.
and or talk to them. Which is why I prefer the New York ethos to the LA ethos, because in New York, you really are up on top of people and people interact.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whether or not they're yelling at you or telling you to go away, they're still interacting
still something.
With you all
there's
the
still
time.
Something happening.
And you're
yes.
really forced to deal with people in New York.
Yeah.
And that doesn't always happen in every place.
Let me end on this happy quote from the article, which was that this guy, Eric Weiner, who's the author of Geography of Bliss, was asked to kind of decode the Happiness Report results. And he said, part of the problem is that we have a huge expectation. Oh, no, sorry. That's not what it was. I started reading the wrong thing. Okay. This is what he said. He said, like, this looks like bad news, right? But A, this angst is very local. And B, it's very recent, which means C, it's not fundamental and going to last forever. If it has been created that quickly, it could be removed that quickly. So we know what the issues are. We can fix them and we can do it, you know, quickly. All right, right. Folks, that is the end of the show. Man, what a fun time. And I just want to be able to make sure that everyone at Fake the Nation knows where to find you and follow everything that you do and see all of your shows. And Andrew, where do they do that?
Just find me at the Yo Is This Racist podcast. Andrew T everywhere. That last name is spelled T-I. I guess Threads? I don't know. My appetite for Threads is a little low, I gotta be honest.
Isn't it? Right?
I don't know.
It started out and then now it's like crappy Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. It's a little snoozy.
I'm not there.
Yeah. So. Okay. So he's not on Threads. What a ringing endorsement for his handle on Threads. But absolutely subscribe to the podcast, Yo, Is This Racist? Now, Greg, where do they find you?
GregProops.com. Jennifer and I conduct a film club every month in LA, and we just showed Exterminating Angel by Buñuel. I do a spiel. Jennifer picks the films, and I do a spiel before the movie. We'll probably have one in April. We show them in Los Angeles, but you can, of course, listen to them online. And then the Smartest Man in the World podcast is still going, albeit more intermittent, because I'm really busy with Who's Live Anyway. We're on the road all the bloody time. I also have an album out called French Drug Deal that's on my website, gregpriest.com, and one I called it In the City. I improvised both the albums in San Francisco. I also made another album at New Year's, and I'm going to put that out, and we're debating on the title. I want to call it German Cinematographer, and Jennifer says that's the least commercial title in the history of mankind. And then the other one, because I look like a German cinematographer.
You do, you do.
Look German. When I go to Germany, people speak German to me.
Yeah.
I want to look like an Italian film star. I do not. I could accept an award in Germany, and you would absolutely, if you saw the picture of me holding
it,
the award,
it would just
up,
work.
Like,
yeah.
Look at that German guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then the other title I wanted to do was someone said to me in Madison, Wisconsin, it's the hip part of Wisconsin. And I was like, is that like the black part of Beverly Hills? I'm not quite understanding. So I also wanted to call the album the hip part of Wisconsin. And Jennifer was like, no. So
you're alienating your Wisconsinian listeners.
Putting it out.
Yeah.
I improvise my albums now. I don't sit down and write everything. They're still really funny. So come on and join me there. I think that's everything. I don't know what else
like, it's on my bucket list to be at one of your improvised album tapings and to be at a film night in Los Angeles. And I have, it is truly like, I will arrange a trip one of these days to make that happen for myself. So, and I encourage all listeners to do the same. But in the meantime, go ahead and find them online. And I you know where to find me and all the things that I do. And I just wanted to close this episode by saying that I lost a friend yesterday. And I only mention it because, you know, we were young together. And you know, when you start talking to people when you're a teenager and you develop a sense of humor, and Leonard is part of my sense of humor. That's part of the reason I'm like the podcaster that I am and the comedian that I am. And so reach out to your friends, especially the ones that are battling with something, because they might need your help. And so if you have that needling feeling, this is me reminding you to give into that needling feeling and pick up the phone and call them with your voice. All right. Thanks for everyone who makes the show a possibility. And we'll be back in your earballs next week.